I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour is Evan Thomas. Evan is the author of Being Nixon, A Man Divided. Evan was a writer, correspondent, and editor for 33 years at Time and Newsweek. And he writes in part of the book that in 1988, Nixon came to talk with editors and writers of Newsweek and came up to the author and said, "Your grandfather was a great man." And Evan was taken aback. He'd never met Nixon, and his grandfather, Norman Thomas, had been the leader of the Socialist Party in America for many years, from the 20s to the 90s. Nixon, he writes, in his careful and always prepared way, must have looked at the attendance list and done some homework. Being Nixon is the name of the book, and it is just really fascinating, so fascinating that I read it on my vacation. I read it instead of looking at the bald eagles some days. Evan was 10 years Washington Bureau Chief at Newsweek, the author of 9 books, including The Very Best Men, The Early Years of the CIA, Robert Kennedy, His Life, President Eisenhower's Secret Battle to Save the World, Sea of Thunder, 4 Commanders in the Last Great Naval Campaign, 41 to 45. He's written many other books as well, and he has taught writing and journalism at Harvard and at Princeton. We're going to be welcoming phone calls. I hope some of you have had a chance to read the book. It's really very, very well done. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, email talk at WPR.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Evan, thank you very much for being with us.
Kathleen, thank you for having me.
Yeah, I thoroughly enjoyed the book, and I even read it on vacation, I must tell you. It was worth it. I got totally absorbed. So you start the book, and I can't get this image out of my mind now, Evan, of the 2000th birthday celebration of Virgil's Aeneid at the Latin Club of Whittier High School in May of 1929. It's just a wonderful story. And in some ways, it says a lot about the Richard Nixon that we knew as a politician. In some ways, we saw a lot of the personality when he was 16.
Yeah. I mean, Nixon was a very shy, awkward boy, and he never kissed a girl before. But as part of the play, Aeneas has to kiss Queen Dido. So the first time he ever kissed a girl was on stage, kissing this nice girl named Ola Florence Welsh. And Nixon's feet hurt. His shoes were too small. He stumbled over, clumsy. And, of course, the audience of teenage high school kids burst into laughter, hooting, catcalls, jokes and laughter. They had to stop the play because it just couldn't go on. And Nixon wrote, it was the most mortifying experience he ever had. It was just horrendous. And yet, you know, a lot of 17-year-olds, 16-year-olds would have been defeated by this. Nixon was not. He became a successful actor in high school, and I love this. What's more, he got the girl. The girl, Ola Florence, wrote in her diary, "How I hate Richard Nixon," a feeling that a lot of people would have in later years.
Yes.
But she wooed her, typical determination. He wooed her and won her. They were boyfriend and girlfriend all through college. She finally dumped him. But she's a very pretty girl and a very smart girl, and she saw in Nixon these qualities that could easily be overlooked.
Mm-hmm. And Pat saw those qualities after he wooed her pretty hard for a while,
right,
too, including driving her to places where she was meeting other guys on dates, and he would drive her there?
Yeah. I mean, can you imagine? He would drive Pat on her dates and then sit in a hotel lobby or you're reading a book while she went on the date and then take her home. Talk about persistence. It took a couple of years, but she gradually saw this shy, awkward guy was thoughtful and deeply ambitious and had a sense of destiny, and he was going to be her ticket out. She'd been a poor, mm-hmm, just like Nixon had been a poor boy,
mm-hmm,
she was a poor girl. She'd had a tough life. She watched her father beat her mother, have a dirt floor, and Nixon, not so rough in Nixon's house, but pretty bad. His father was a bully, and his mother was a saint, but kind of a passive-aggressive saint. Anyways, they saw in each other some spark, and she finally came around, and their early marriage is actually very romantic. Their love letters are very real.
Mm-hmm. I guess I also hadn't realized, and I was thinking of the Kennedy family, too, when you write about all the tragedy, you know, with his Harold, you describe his tall, blonde, handsome older brother, who you probably saw the family rooting behind to become a big success in life, who died. And I kept thinking of Joe Kennedy, yeah, and the Kennedy family. And you've got somebody who's scrawny like Jack Kennedy. And you've got Richard, who, as you say, is the opposite of Harold, but losing two of his brothers, and it kind of threw him for a while. Well, as it would, but it really did throw him.
Well, it did. I mean, his mother thought that he was spent his life trying to live up to the fact that his two brothers had died, and just try to, you know, meet the parents' expectations for all of them. It was a very heavy burden, but it was also inspiring. And your example of Jack Kennedy is interesting, because Jack Kennedy was not the fair-haired boy in his family. His older brother Joe was. And, you know, Jack was kind of sickly and, you know, beautiful boy and all that, but quiet. And his brother's death, I think, gave him a kind of depth of character that Nixon also had to have. I think it hurt him and it wounded him, but it also, that kind of suffering can give you a kind of depth of character and drive that the rest of us don't have. So for better, for, you know, these things can shape you in so many ways.
Right. Yes.
For better and for worse.
Yeah, how true. And that really runs true throughout your book. He would also, this is a pretty young age to be, as you write, lecturing bewildered young children on the candidates in the upcoming national election. He was in second grade in 1920.
Right.
That's incredible.
Right. He was obviously a precocious kid. He was always top of his class. And but one of his defenses was to read the newspapers and to intellectualize things so he could debate with his father, who was semi-literate and kind of a bully, very opinionated. And Nixon learned how to defend himself by debate. Nixon's father would hit his kids occasionally, not so unusual in that generation. And Nixon, you know, learned to, his resource was political debate and to defend himself by knowing a lot, by being prepared. It produces some ridiculous scenes, like him lecturing second graders on national politics, but it's a sign of the kind of precociousness that would carry him all his life.
Mm. And what about his mom, who he referred to as a saint?
She was a pretty passive-aggressive saint. I mean, he always said that, and she was a Quaker. She was very kind of devout. His father, interesting, was evangelical and out there and loud. His mom prayed in the closet, was, you know, that interior faith of the Quakers have. But she would, you know, described by the cousins as somebody who, you know, when she got angry, she was very quiet. And it was scarier. She had kind of a velvet fist. Her suppressed anger was scarier than the father's actual anger. Mm. And I think Nixon was never comfortable with his parents. Henry Kissinger said, can you imagine what Nixon would have been like if he had been loved?
I know. Yeah.
I think Kissinger's exaggerating. I think Nixon was loved, but I understand the point.
Yes.
Nixon was never really comfortable. He never had that unconditional love that we want to give our own kids.
Right. I didn't know this about him either, because he kind of railed against people like you, the Harvard East Coast establishment folks, and then would put him in positions of power. But I didn't realize that he had won this outstanding all-around student from the Harvard Club and could have applied for a tuition scholarship from Harvard and later had a similar offer from Yale.
Yeah, he did. I mean, he won the Harvard Club of California Prize. He was a top kid in his high school. And in those days, that meant you got a scholarship. But Nixon was so poor that his family couldn't handle the travel expenses, because the older brother had TB and was sick, and they had used whatever cash they had to take care of him. So Nixon, in his sort of bitter way, always said, well, my Harvard friends, if we didn't have many, but my Harvard friends will be disappointed to know that I got there in there too, but couldn't go back in, 1929. Nixon had this weird love-hate thing about Harvard, mostly hate, but, I mean, we'll put it this way, he railed against it. No more of those Harvard bastards, he would say in my cabinet. And yet, as you pointed out, he hired a lot of them.
Right.
His chief foreign policy advisor, Henry Kissinger, was a Harvard professor. His chief domestic policy advisor, Daniel Patrick Moynihan, was a Harvard professor. So, you know, he would, this typical of Nixon, yell, carry on, rant about how terrible the place was, but then if he needed to, hire somebody from there.
Mm-hmm. And you were worried, I would imagine, I don't know if you were worried or not, but here you had, as you write later on in the book, old Nixon hands who may have been suspicious of you because of that suspicion that he had of the East Coast establishment. But all of the people that you talked to were quite helpful in research about the book because they wanted a fuller portrait of him. Is that the reason?
Yes. I mean, well, a lot of things. One is time passes, you know.
Right.
So people are willing to talk. I found this with the CIA. If you found CIA officers 20 or 30 years later, they'd tell you a lot of stuff that they wouldn't have told you at the time. So that's part of it. But part of it is that I said, and I meant it, that I didn't want to do the cartoon version of Nixon. I didn't want to do the Hollywood Oliver Stone, oh my God, he's this wicked, monstrous, dreadful figure. Nixon had a dark side for sure, and I definitely bring it out in the book. But he was not this caricature of the Herblock cartoon of this guy with a 5 o'clock shadow crawling out of the sewer. He may have seemed that way, but I just knew he couldn't really act. People aren't really that way. So I went to these people who'd worked for Nixon, and I said, "Look, I know I'm suspect. I work for the Washington Post Company for 24 years. Washington Post Company, which basically got Nixon and Watergate. So I would." The kind of guy that would be on Nixon's enemies list. But that's not what I'm trying to do here. There have been a dozen books written about Nixon. I want to do something different, to be more sympathetic if I can be. And to their, and I'm grateful for this, they, by and large, not all of them, but almost all of them, said, okay, well, let's talk.
Mm-hmm.
And they did tell me stuff because he's a figure of fascination to them, too. To work for Richard Nixon is to wonder about this.
Right.
You know, they protected him, they defended him, but he's a strange guy. His own chief of staff, H.R. Haldeman, said that Richard Nixon was the weirdest man I ever met.
Right.
That's his ever loyal chief of staff.
Yeah. You describe that relationship as almost like a marriage, Haldeman-Nixon.
Yeah, not a great marriage. Haldeman was devoted to Nixon, but Nixon was weird, to use Haldeman's word. Nixon never asked Haldeman about his family, about his wife, Joe. I mean, he would run into Joe. I interviewed Joe, his wife, and she said that every time she met Nixon, Nixon would say, well, how's the drinking problem? And she would go, what? She was a Christian Scientist. They were both teetotal. It was just his way of awkward. He had this awkward way of making bad jokes, sometimes bad off-color jokes. He did this every time with her, and she would, you know, kind of smile and pretend not to notice and play along with it. But it was just kind of sad. Nixon couldn't relax enough to befriend her. Even she's a wonderful woman. It's sad that he wasn't able to befriend her, and he never really befriended Haldeman, her husband.
Yeah.
Even though Haldeman spent 24/7 working for him.
Mm-hmm. And the other story that makes you go, did he really say this, is where he's in a motorcade somewhere in Florida and one of the motorcycle police officers has an accident. Tell us that story.
Yeah. This is so Nixon. I mean, Nixon was very solicitous of people who work for him. So he's in a motorcade and one of the motorcycle guys crashes and he's lying under his motorcycle and Nixon gets out of the car and goes over to him and looks down at this poor guy lying there and says, are you happy in your work?
Oh, jeez.
You know, people just can't believe it.
No, you can't.
He did this, one of my favorites. He's a blurt. I do this kind of thing at cocktail parties when I'm nervous. He blurred things out. And so Nixon's at Martin Luther King's funeral, 1968, and he runs into Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis. And he says, oh, Mrs. Kennedy, this must bring back memories.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, my gosh. You just cringe.
You
didn't mean it. You know, he just didn't know what to say. He really rather prefer not talking to anybody at all. Well, he was a great reader. One reason why he read so much is he didn't want to talk to people.
And yet,
we had one friend, really, B.B. Rebozo. The basis of their relationship was that they didn't talk.
And yet he's running for president, for heaven's sake, and for vice president, and for the House, and unbelievable that he would choose that profession.
Well, right. One reason why I wrote this book was I was just fascinated by this question. How did this shy, introverted boy become one of the most successful politicians of the 20th century? He was on 5 national tickets. Only FDR did that. He won 4 times. In 1972, he won by, I think, the third largest landslide in history. He won every state but Massachusetts and D.C. He was a fantastically successful politician, but he was totally incapable of making kind of standard small talk. It's just miraculous how he did it.
Yeah. What did Eisenhower really think of him, Evan?
That's got another sad story, because Nixon was a good vice president to Ike, and for 8 years, you know, very good with foreign leaders and very good on, and things that are surprise you. Nixon was good on civil rights in the 1950s. People don't think of him.
Helped desegregate schools, right?
Yeah, no, he did, and he as president, he did. But as vice president, back to Ike, he was kind of Nixon's point man on civil rights. He was close to Martin Luther King.
Mm-hmm.
But Eisenhower never really liked Nixon. I wrote a book about Eisenhower, and John Eisenhower, who was Eisenhower's son, told me my father gave himself an order to like Dick Nixon.
Hmm.
You know, he just mm-hmm. couldn't. Nixon was hard to warm up to. He was not an unsympathetic character, but he was so awkward and kind of distant. And Ike just didn't really like him all that much. He respected him. He needed him. But he tried to dump Nixon from the ticket in 52 during the famous fund scandal that produced the Checkers speech. Some of you
right.
listeners may remember that one. And then he tried to dump him in 56 for a good reason, to make him Secretary of Defense so that he could get a little management experience. And then he, in 1960, this is the worst of all, August 1960, by now, Vice President Nixon's running for president. He's the Republican nominee. And at a press conference, Eisenhower is asked, well, will you tell us something that Vice President Nixon did to further American foreign policy? And Ike answers, well, if you give me a week, I'll think of something.
What an answer.
Oh my God. I mean, think how wounding that was.
Right.
To Richard Nixon. Now, there's a lot of explanations for it. He was being flippant, or he was tired, or, you know, you can talk your way around it. But the words, they're there on the page.
Yeah, and all these years later, we remember that, don't we?
Yeah, we do. In fact, in the famous 1960 debate, it's the first question Nixon got asked. Vice President Eisenhower said XXX. Poor Nixon, who's nervous, you know, here he is in his first televised debate against Kennedy. That's the first question out of the blocks by Sandra Van Oker of NBC.
Mm. And he looked so bad that night that his mom called and asked, is Richard sick, for the first debate with Kennedy?
Yeah, goodness. Yeah. I mean, you know, debates now, as we know from recent debates, have evolved a long way. But this was the very beginning. This is the very first presidential debate. And they didn't understand about makeup. And so Kennedy, who was, you know, had been sunning that afternoon, his usual tan, glamorous self, looked cool. Right before the debate, they asked Kennedy, do you want makeup? And he says no. And they asked Nixon, so he's got to be a manly guy, so he says no, too. Well, Kennedy goes back into his dressing room and is made up with, you know, high-end Max Factor cream puff. Nixon gets an aide to go down to Michigan Avenue and buy a stick of, I think it was called Shave Stick, this hideous grease that he put on himself to cover his 5 o'clock shadow.
Oh.
And, of course, he sweated through it.
Yeah.
It was yucky. And everybody could see it on TV.
It was bad. What do you think? Were there real shenanigans going on in that election? Do you think that it could have been that Nixon won?
Yes. I think most scholars have looked at this do think that in Chicago the vote was fixed. Mm. Now, there's always been a debate because the Republicans were stealing votes downstate as the Democrats were stealing votes in Chicago. But I think that you can make a pretty good case that in a very close race, Mayor Daley's machine delivered Chicago illegally through vote fixing to Kennedy. And in Texas, there was also voter fraud. Had Nixon won those two states, he would have been president. Nixon chose not to challenge the result for the virtuous reason that, as he said, you know, we're in the middle of a Cold War, a very tense Cold War, and the country really cannot stand months of uncertainty over this. So he conceded, but he could have brought lawsuits, and I think some scholars who study this really do think that in terms of popular vote, Nixon won.
Hmm. Evan Thomas is our guest this hour. His book is Being Nixon, A Man Divided. And we're welcoming phone calls. And here's how you reach us. The number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Today, we're talking about the story of Richard Nixon, which is very interestingly told and in great detail from his very early years, starting when he was 16 and reminiscing before that all the way to his death in Being Nixon, A Man Divided. Evan Thomas is our guest, and Evan is the author of a number of books, and he also worked at Time and Newsweek, Washington bureau chief at Newsweek for 10 years. He was editor at large. He wrote 100 cover stories, and in 1999 won a National Magazine Award. He's written many, many books, including books on Eisenhower. And we have a lot of phone calls coming in, so let's go to a few of them, Evan, and we start with Zach in Ripon. Hi, Zach.
Hi, Kathleen. Hi, Evan. How are you?
Hi, good.
Evan, I'd like you to talk a little bit about Nixon's relationship with Spiro Agnew, who is an often overlooked political figure, and maybe talk about the selection of Agnew. And does this selection sort of portend the direction of the Republican Party for years afterwards?
Well, actually, Agnew, interestingly, was considered to be liberal. He was a liberal mid-Atlantic state governor, not very well known. And in those days, the Republican Party had liberals and moderates and Northeast moderates. So he was initially intended to win those votes. But Nixon picked him partly because, well, he was Greek for one thing, and Nixon had some Greek contributors that helped. But also because he'd standed up to some black militants, Nixon liked that, and he thought that Agnew had a good presence. Now, Nixon never consulted Agnew on anything substantive. He did not respect Agnew's political judgment. Agnew was basically frozen out with one important exception. Nixon used Agnew to rag on the press. He gave him Pat Buchanan and Sapphire, very, very clever speechwriters, and they wrote these attacks on the press, the nattering nabobs.
Of negativity. I remember that.
Remember that?
Yep.
And it was very effective because Nixon knew that in the late 60s, there was a lot of feeling that the East Coast media establishment was unelected, unaccountable. This all heralds Roger Ailes and Fox. This is before there's ever a Fox. Nixon understands that in the country, and in many parts of the country, people resent the media elite. They don't think that the media elite speaks for them. It's too liberal. It's too whatever. And Nixon sent Agnew out there to whip those folks up and to attack the establishment press. Rather than Nixon having to do it himself, had Agnew in the classic role of the vice presidential hitman, Nixon himself had performed that role for Dwight Eisenhower. And so Agnew faithfully did that. The only problem with Agnew was that he was taking cash in brown paper bags.
That wasn't correct.
And got caught by the Justice Department and then had to resign.
Yeah. Well, bringing up the word liberal, as you write, accomplishments, opening up China, achieving arms control with the Soviet Union, desegregating southern schools, increasing benefits for the elderly and the disabled, creating the EPA, looking at health care reform. Some historians, you say, call him a liberal, but he was not. Wasn't he a liberal when you list those kinds of accomplishments?
Yeah, it sure sounds like it. But his rhetoric was very conservative. Had he had a second term, I think he would have turned pretty sharply to the right. What Nixon really was an activist who believed that you ought to get things done. Mm. This is in contrast to today, when Congress is dysfunctional and the Republican right really wants to stop anything from happening. Nixon was from an earlier era that believed that you had to compromise, that government was there to do things. And he was working with an all-Democratic Congress, Democratic-controlled Congress. He was the first president in 100 years to have the other party control Congress, both House and Senate. And he thought you had to work with them. So a lot of those bills that you rattle off there were Democratic initiatives, but Nixon either got ahead of them or joined them. He had a lot of floating coalitions. He was expedient. I mean, just to give one example, the environmental movement was just getting going in those days. And but the leader of it was a guy named Ed Muskie, Senator Ed Muskie of Maine.
Mm-hmm.
And Nixon saw that Muskie could be the 1972 Democratic nominee. So Nixon, who loved to confound his enemies, to sort of do end runs on his enemies, tried to basically one-up Muskie by creating the Environmental Protection Agency. That's really why Nixon created the EPA, was it was political expedience to kind of outdo, to outflank, if you will, Muskie to the left. Now, it was a good thing that he did that, but he was doing it, he was politically motivated.
Let's go to Nate in Milwaukee next. Hi, Nate.
Hi, Kathleen. Every night before I go to bed, I thank God for John F. Kennedy, because he was there in October 62, and everything your guest is saying about Nixon, we would just be proteins of dust had Nixon been president. And he met Alma Virumque Carnot in 1929 in his Latin class, but he had the biggest potty mouth on those Watergate tapes.
What about those? He did have what he said about Jews and racist comments.
Yes, I mean, those tapes make you cringe.
Yeah.
They do, and anti-Semitic stuff is particularly distasteful, really. I just plain ugly.
Mm-hmm.
But as with everything with Nixon, it is complicated. Nixon, some of that blustering is just showing off. This is partly a generational thing. People have watched the show Mad Men will understand this. This kind of need to swagger, show what a tough guy you are by swearing a lot. A lot of these guys were World War II vets who learned how to swear. They're college boys who learned how to swear to be sure they were how tough they were in World War II, and never forgot, including, I would say, John F. Kennedy, who swore just as much. We don't have tapes of Kennedy, but he had just as much of a potty mouth as Richard Nixon did. We just don't have the tapes of him talking that way. So Nixon did swear too much. What really bothered me more than the profanity was the arrogance. Nixon could sound very arrogant. There was a kind of swagger to him, you know, we're right, they're wrong. And a kind of lack of self-awareness. As I listened to those tapes, the crudeness was unpleasant, but what was more unpleasant was Nixon needing to kind of strut and show off and always show that he was right. You know, deep down, I don't think he really felt that way, but he sounds that way on the tapes.
Was he anti-Semitic? Was he a racist?
On the anti-Semitism, again, I hate to be so wishy-washy about this, but it's complicated. He said terrible stuff. He wanted to count the number of Jews in the Bureau of Labor Statistics. I mean, it's just awful. But he was a very good friend of Israel. In 1973, in the Yom Kippur War, when the State Department and Defense Department are dragging their heels, Nixon, the president, orders us to fly all our planes over there to bring supplies, to resupply Israel. And they were cheering in the streets in Tel Aviv. And Nixon was very close to Golda Meir, the Israeli prime minister. So, yes, Nixon said this terrible stuff, but he saved Israel. And I think and Golda Meir would second that statement. Nixon, closest foreign policy advisor, Henry Kissinger, of course, you know, was Jewish. Nixon's speechwriter, Sapphire, head of the Federal Reserve, Burns. So he wasn't anti-Semitic in his hiring policy, but he sounds pretty bad on those tapes.
Right. Thank you, Nate, so much for your call. Scott in La Crosse. Hi, Scott.
Hey there, Kathleen.
Hi.
Welcome back. Glad you had a good time.
Welcome back to you. Haven't heard from you in a while, sir.
Yeah, I was telling Scotty I've been pretty busy doing volunteer stuff.
Good.
So a lot of my afternoons have been pretty booked lately. On the other hand, I do listen whenever I get a chance and always enjoy the program.
Thank you. Thanks, Scott. Good to hear from you.
So, yeah, good to be talking to you again, too, Kathleen. My question for the guest is, there was a book out a while back called Nixon's Good Deed. And what it was about was that at some point during his presidency, supposedly, Nixon wanted to get passed legislation that would guarantee a minimum income for all American citizens.
Right.
And the liberals, the Democrats, fought this because the amount was too low, you know, tragic mistake. Because once you get it in place, you can always raise it.
Hmm.
And I just wondered if your guest had any information about that how dedicated Nixon was to.
It's one of the more interesting Nixon chapters. Nixon, this conservative Republican president, introduces something called the Family Assistance Plan in 1970. And it was, this is Pat Moynihan's idea. I mentioned earlier that Nixon hired, even though he hates Harvard, he hires as his chief domestic advisor a Harvard professor named Daniel Patrick Moynihan, who was a brilliant guy, disaffected from the Democratic Party, but a brilliant guy who had this idea of, look, welfare, instead of this vast welfare bureaucracy, which is, you know, actually breaking up poor families, let's just give everybody a guaranteed minimum income. They have to work. They have to show that they're either working in a low-wage job or get taking worker training. So like, it's not just a dole. But let's make sure that, you know, we give everybody a guaranteed minimum income. It was actually the beginnings. It was sort of 20 years ahead of its time. It was the basis of what later became known as welfare reform in the 1990s. Ahead of its time in 1970-71, it was shot down by far-right Republicans who just thought it was the dole, but also liberal Democrats, who, as your questioner points out, thought it wasn't generous enough. They used a crude euphemism, and I won't repeat on the air to say what FAP stands for. And so the thing didn't succeed in the Senate, but it's typical of Nixon that he had this kind of fresh approach. Nixon liked to say, I don't like intellectuals, I only like to talk to athletes. But he was actually a poor athlete himself, and he liked intellectuals. He would say that, but he was, for a president, incredibly well-read. Yeah. I asked the Nixon Library to show me his private library, and they did. And he's reading political philosophy and political theory,
yes,
political biography and underlining. And, you know, he was a deeply thoughtful, original thinker. Going to China, that was a pretty original thing for a Republican president to do. And he, you know, he was always looking for new ways of doing things. So that was the, you know, it didn't pass, but it was a pretty smart idea, and it laid the groundwork for the welfare reform, which did pass in the 1990s.
Thank you, Scott, so much for your call. One of those political books he was reading that was heavily underlined was about Charles de Gaulle, who Nixon thought the world of. Why did he think the world of him?
Well, I think this is kind of a mistake on Nixon's part. Nixon, because he was so lonely, liked the model of de Gaulle as the remote, aloof, almost godlike leader. You know, de Gaulle had this whole idea of the majesty of the office and that you should be a remote and kind of grand. You know, they called de Gaulle Le Grand Charles.
Mm-hmm.
And Nixon met de Gaulle in the 1960s. Nixon liked to travel abroad and meet with foreign leaders. That was a good thing he did. And he and Nixon and de Gaulle kind of bonded. And Nixon thought, this is a great model. I'll do this. I mean, I'll try to be a president who's remote and grand like de Gaulle. Bad idea. Nixon's not de Gaulle. He couldn't pull it off. Nixon's not a grand person. He just didn't have the... So it looked ridiculous. He did things like get these guards' uniforms to make the White House seem more like a palace. It looked like a comic opera. It only lasted a week. I think those uniforms ended up in a high school band in the U.S. You know, it just accentuated his awkwardness.
Yeah. Well, let's go to Vietnam for a moment, because he certainly dealt with that for a long period of time. And let's go to the time where... he may have sabotaged peace plans that were underway, where LBJ was hoping that he could turn the election to Hubert Humphrey, and Nixon was doing some back channel things here. Explain all of that to us.
Yeah, this is a story that sounds bad, but it actually sounds worse than it is. But it sounds very bad. This is on the eve of the 1968 election, and President Johnson, looking for a way out of Vietnam, says, let's have peace talks, cease the bombing, and let's have peace talks in Paris. Meanwhile, Nixon thinks, oh my God, if this happens, if this is at the last minute like this, Humphrey, my Democratic opponent, Vice President Johnson's vice president, he's going to win. So Nixon signals President Chu in Vietnam, don't take the deal. You'll get a better deal with me. Do not go to Paris. Now, on its face, President Johnson knew about this because they were wiretapping. Of course, the CIA was wiretapping the South Vietnamese embassy and actually Chu's office. So President Johnson found out about this and said it's treason. You know, this is treason. And this story has come out in recent years. And it sounds really bad, and it is bad, except for this. President Chu was not going to make any deal What Nixon did didn't really make any difference. The most recent documents show the president too was never going to take the deal. So the signal he got from Nixon was meaningless because Chu was never going to say yes. Yes, Nixon's intent was bad here. He meant to meddle, and he did. But the actual impact was insignificant because Chu was never going to take the deal.
Yeah. But there's also another thing that carries on, doesn't it, where he thinks that LBJ has bugged his campaign plane.
Yes,
and so
right.
he, if the Democrats are doing this, it sort of, does it, yeah. is it fair to say, start the whole thing rolling? Well, I'm going to do whatever I can to get the Democrats, including breaking
yeah.
into Watergate or
yeah.
Daniel Ellsberg's office.
Yes. Ken Hughes, who's a scholar who listened to a lot of Nixon tapes, first came up with this, and he's on to something, because you have to follow the bouncing ball here, but J. Edgar Hoover, the head of the FBI, tells Nixon, new President Nixon, Johnson bugged your plane.
Mm-hmm.
Now, here's what's weird about it. It wasn't true. Johnson did not bug Nixon's plane, but Hoover wanted Nixon to think that, because Hoover wanted Nixon to think, oh my gosh, Hoover knows all his secrets, right? Because
mm-hmm.
that's an insurance policy for Hoover. This is the way Hoover operated. Hoover stayed in power through many presidents by making those presidents think that he knew all their dirty secrets.
Mm-hmm.
So Hoover persuades Nixon that, oh my gosh, the FBI bugged Nixon's plane, and the FBI knows about every bad thing that Richard Nixon ever did. So Nixon is infuriated by this, and it sort of gets into his dark side. And he thinks, you know, if they're bugging me, I can bug them too. And it just it ratchets things up so that when, flash forward a couple of years later, Daniel Ellsberg leaks to the New York Times this kind of secret history to the Vietnam War, the famous Pentagon Papers, Nixon kind of goes crazy, and he wants to break into the Brookings Institution, which is a liberal think tank in Washington, and find not just the Pentagon Papers, but secret reports on what Johnson knew about Nixon in 1968 in this attempt to fix the election. You know, Nixon is, just as you say, Nixon thinks, well, the other side's doing it, I'm going to do it too. And he goes a little bit crazy. And this really is the beginning of Watergate.
Yeah.
Watergate really gets its start the summer of 1971 when Nixon wants the FBI to do it. The FBI doesn't want to do it, partly because Hoover is smart enough to see that it's a bad business to be in, and so he's getting the FBI out of that business. So what does Nixon do? He goes in-house. He creates his own unit called the Plumbers, famous name.
Right.
But they hire a couple of clowns. E. Howard Hunt and Gordon Liddy, who are bad, who get caught. They screw up. They break into Ellsberg's psychiatrist's office, and they make a hash of that. And then, famously, they break into the Watergate, the Democratic National Committee headquarters in Watergate, and they get caught. And that was the beginning of the end for Richard Nixon.
Our guest this hour is the author of Being Nixon, A Man Divided. Evan Thomas is our guest, New York Times bestselling author. He was with Newsweek and Time magazine for a long time, correspondent, writer, editor for 33 years at Time and Newsweek, the author of many books. We have a lot of you on hold. Please be with us for just a couple minutes, and we'll get back and start taking more phone calls. The number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, email talk at WPR.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We'd love to hear your thoughts about Richard Nixon there. We have yet to talk about Elvis Presley. I promised the Elvis Presley story last hour, more about Watergate, more about his fall from office, and his writing his memoir when he was out of office, how he refashioned himself, the presidents who snubbed him, the presidents who asked for his advice, Pat's death, his death, and more about the Nixon family. Can we do all that in a short time? We'll try. And we'll do it in a minute. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Back to phone calls for Evan Thomas, and we go to Jim in Rice Lake next. Hi, Jim.
Hi. I have one question for your guest and one comment. The question is if he's read Perlman's Nixon Land, the theme of which is ever since Whittier College, he viewed himself as an underdog victim, which resulted in his debacle throughout his presidency and even before. And my comment is the following. Texas was a yellow dog Democrat state in '60. That wasn't going to go to Nixon. And this while Illinois may have been swung, it wasn't enough electorally to change the election. What's changed the election fundamentally was Nixon's tactical mistake to promise to campaign in every state, and Dwight Eisenhower's famous, when asked about Richard Nixon, give me a week and I'll come up with an answer as to something he did good. And that Eisenhower could have won the election for Nixon, and he stayed on the sidelines. I'll take my answer off the air.
All right. Thanks, Jim.
Those are all factors. I mean, you know, everything that you say is true. Yes, I have read Rick Perlstein's book. I mean, Nixon was both hurt by this feeling of being an outsider and his resentment against, but also helped by it. Nixon was brilliant at getting the votes of outsiders. You know, he won 35% of Democratic votes, of registered Democrats in 1972, because he could peel away those New Deal Democrats by playing to their resentment, to their fear. Perlstein writes a lot about this. Sort of a populist message playing against their resentment of the elites and against social permissiveness and against liberalism. Nixon was a master at playing on that, and it gave him a landslide victory in 1972 against George McGovern.
A couple little stories I wanted to have you be sure and tell, because it gives you just an idea of what he was doing during the day. This yellow legal pad thing, I mean, I found it almost humorous in a way, but also kind of sad how he would write down the kind of person he wanted to be, the attributes that he found admirable, and he wanted to be that way.
Yeah, it's pointed late at night. People used to say his yellow pad was his best friend.
Oh.
Yeah. And he would write down, he would use the word joy and inspiring and serenity, all these things he really couldn't be but wanted to be. It was very affecting to me to read that. I mean, it undercuts this idea of this vile monster. He really wanted to be a better person. He was not able to be that person. But that doesn't mean he didn't want to be it. And sometimes he was, sometimes he wasn't, and he definitely, sometimes he was not. But he, you know, he was a conflicted person.
But didn't he realize at some point, Evan, the enormity of what resigning from the presidency when he had to do it, didn't he see that coming? Didn't he realize what an utterly disgraceful thing that was?
Yeah, he sure should have. He was not the most self-aware guy. I mean, look, a lot of famous public figures really cannot afford to be self-aware. They can't get up in the morning and doubt themselves. They have to just drive straight ahead. And Nixon was that way. He was kind of lacking in self-awareness. And the thing he really couldn't see, a couple of things. One is that if you attack your enemies, you know, that'll destroy. He says it, actually, as he leaves the White House, his last words are, don't hate your enemies too much or it will destroy you. Too late. That was the central message he failed to understand as president. His enemies destroyed him. The Washington Post, the liberals, they got him. You know, they really did. And he brought that on himself. As he himself later said, I gave them the sword and they stuck it in and twisted it. The other thing about Nixon was he was so shy that he couldn't confront his own subordinates. During Watergate, he didn't know anything about the Watergate break-in. He did not know about that. But he participated in the cover-up, partly because he could not bring himself to confront John Mitchell, Haldeman, you know, and say, what happened here? He never did that, and so he's the controlling officer. In the end, he was swept out with him.
Yeah. Jason in Green Bay. Hi.
Hello. I have a question for your guest. And I have read this story in numerous places that Nixon shared an interest in extraterrestrials and UFOs with his close friend, actor Jackie Gleason. Supposedly, as the story has it, one night Nixon snuck out of the White House in his personal car, picked up Jackie Gleason and showed him the remains of alien bodies that were recovered in Roswell. Does your guest know anything about that?
I don't. Got me there.
Yeah, I haven't heard that either. But you must tell the story for those, I can remember this, I'm old enough to remember it, but the story of his getting up at, unless he was up all night, 5 a.m. to go to the Lincoln Memorial, it's shortly after Kent State, I believe, and meeting with war protesters, that was something.
So weird. I mean, this is the country's blowing up because of Kent State. This is an invasion of Cambodia, National Guard opens up at Kent State and kills those students. And Nixon is really distraught by it, stays up basically all night, and goes at 4 o'clock in the morning, goes to the Lincoln Memorial to take his servant, Manolo, his valet, to show him Lincoln Memorial. And, of course, he runs into their whole lot of anti-war demonstrators there because they're having a march on Washington that day. And you have this bizarre scene of the President of the United States and these kind of scrofulous students having, you know, talking there at dawn, talking past each other, Nixon trying to inspire these kids. These kids wonder, who is this guy? What the hell is he talking about? And it was just a sad, I mean, it was sad. Nixon wanted to say something uplifting to these students, and they thought he was just talking about surfing and football, and they just didn't get it.
Yeah,
It was just kind of a sad encounter.
Yeah, and he didn't get it either a lot, did he? He didn't get it. Yeah. David and Eastman, hi.
Hello, this is great. Quick question. Do you think Richard Nixon had a form of Asperger's? I think some historian wrote about that, didn't they?
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I mean, yeah, I've heard it speculated that they could talk about the spectrum now, the autism spectrum, that he'd be on it somewhere because he wasn't very good at social cues, and he showed some of the mild symptoms, Asperger's type symptoms. That's a very unclinical judgment on my part. I don't know enough about this to really make a judgment, but I too have heard that said, and he certainly had this painful social awkwardness that is sometimes associated with Asperger's syndrome.
Hmm. Tell us the Elvis Presley story. It is remarkable. Yeah. It's really something.
Yeah. Elvis, the king, shows up at the White House one day, and Nixon says, come on in. And they're wonderful photographs of it. Elvis is wearing his cape, you know, wearing his dorky suit. And they bonded in a way because they both kind of hated Ivy Leaguers, and they're both outsiders in their own way, and both patriots in their own way. Now, it was totally weird because Elvis was probably stoned and wanted a badge. Okay, he wanted a Narcotics Bureau badge to help Nixon with the war on drugs. This is all crazy. I mean, you know, boy, Elvis finally later dies of an overdose, I believe.
Exactly.
But Nixon saw in Elvis something that reached, you know, greater America, that a lot of people loved Elvis.
And Elvis brought him a loaded handgun as a present?
Well, I can't remember. I don't think that one got to the Secret Service. But, yeah, he brought his loaded handgun. I mean, you can't make it up.
No.
I think somebody's making a TV show or a movie about that. It's just one of the great American cultural weird moments of all time.
It sure is. And then to get towards his final days in office, this is a scene that you paint, and you can just see it. During the final days of Watergate, you write, it's amazing how little the Nixon family talked about the difficult and embarrassing subjects, dinner talk about mundane things, but then they sent each other notes on pillows or under the doors of the bedrooms. It was like the Tolstoy house. But they couldn't talk about the depth of all that was going on.
Yeah. Oh, it's imagine what it was like. I mean, there you are, about to be the first president driven from office outside. The demonstrators are, you know, you can hear them. They were yelling jail to the chief, and Nixon thought as he was leaving, they were yelling, saying hail to the chief. I mean, it's just heartbreaking. And the family's very close. Julie and Tricia, the daughters, really are very close to their father. And Pat was a loving wife, but, you know, they were an earlier generation, and they just couldn't, they couldn't share, you know, the way we emotionally share with each other, try to. They just couldn't do that, and so they talked around it. So they would leave each other little notes. As Frank Gannon, who was Nixon's ghostwriter, told me, it was like out of a Tolstoy novel, leaving little notes on their pillows at night, expressing their love for each other and saying the things that they just couldn't say to each other face-to-face.
Mm. Oh, well, I just thoroughly enjoyed the book. Did you enjoy writing it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Total fun. I mean, I've read 9 books. This is the most fun book by far.
Why? Why, Evan?
Because he's so, as Haldeman said, the weirdest guy ever made. So interesting. I mean, somebody so shy could have been so effective. Somebody so powerful, so canny, opens up China, arms control of the Soviet Union, and then destroys himself.
Right.
I mean, it's a Shakespearean tale.
It is,
you cannot believe the heights that he reaches and the depths that he reaches. And it's just a fascinating you can't make this stuff up. I don't think if I was writing fiction, I could write a more thrilling novel than The Life of Richard Nixon.
Well, you wrote a great piece of nonfiction, and thank you so much, Evan, for being with us.
Thank you, Kathleen. Really enjoyed it.
Evan Thomas, the book is Being Nixon, A Man Divided. Evan worked for Time and Newsweek for a long, long period of time and is the author of 9 books, including The Wise Men with Walter Isaacson, The Man to See, The Very Best Men, Robert Kennedy, John Paul Jones, Sea of Thunder, Ike's Bluff, and Being Nixon. Thanks to K.P. Whaley and Scotty Myers for producing this program, and thanks, everybody, for your interest in the subject. We'll be with you again tomorrow at 1 o'clock, so I hope you'll join us then. Coming up, the news from National Public Radio and then Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.